All right, well, thanks for Wick and the organizers for inviting me. Like Ken, I'm not going to talk about any actual calculations. These are opportunities or prospects for calculations. And of course, it's early stuff I can skip over because you've been hearing this. So the Hadron parity violation, parity non-conservation is tiny. We either need very sensitive measurements, which of course people are working on, or good amplification. And so we can do that in first order perturbation theory by looking for small energy denominators. We look for small nearby parity doublets. So the classic, what I call the gang of four, in terms of light nuclei, nitrogen 14, fluorine 18, 19, and neon 21. I want to talk a little bit about fluorine 18, although again, I want to be talking more about opportunities, the modern shell model possibilities. The Van Cheer, of course, the ground state is 1+, but there's a low-lying 0+, 0- parity doublet, which is separated by only 39 keV. So this is very attractive because they're very close line. So here's an example, not exactly this scale. Here's the fluorine 18 ground state. There's a 3+ state, but then these two 0- and 0+ states, again, separated by only a few KV. And so you can actually measure, put a limit on parity violation by circular polarization, which Eric and collaborators did many years ago, 1980, at least an upper limit. I don't think there's been any other measurements of this since then, has there?
Well, there have been other measurements, but they're all consistent with zero.
Okay, so anyway, there's an upper limit, and one can also try to relate this to parity mixing in the beta decay from nearby neon 18, where there's a super loud decay to the 0+, but then there's a small admixture into the 0-, which is on the order of 10⁻⁴. And people like Wick have looked at this. Now this is, it's one of the things tricky is there's a two-body current, of course, that you're trying to calculate. Although hopefully with new ab initio methods or with the EFT calculations, with EFT or lattice QCD, as Andre was talking about earlier, we might be able to do a better job of really nailing down how to write down those two-body operators. But an old idea is to relate the two-body operators to the one-body operators like sigma dot p, which is basically the first forbidden equivalent of gamma of Teller. And this is stuff Wick's working on and was related in a paper that I did as a grad student with Wick, which basically I ran the computers and Wick understood what it meant. So what I'm going to talk about today is what's happening with configuration, interaction, shell models, and I think I'll be able to squeeze this down to about 45 minutes. No, that's a joke. I'm just going to give you this sparse outline. The advantage of the configuration, interaction, shell model, it's a flexible microscopic model, but now with much more rigorous ab initio foundations, or as Ken said, you can diagonalize once and get lots of eigenvalues. So it's sort of the exact opposite of what he did. Of course, there is the conservation of work, and so we have other problems than the quantum Monte Carlo work that he was describing. But the basic idea here is that what we want to do is to compute these matrix elements of modern, in particular, two-body parity-violating operators. We can check the robustness against model space, interaction, and so forth. And we can also check this hypothesis of proportionality between the two and one-body operators, basically sigma dot p. And the basic thing we want to do is we want to solve Schrödinger's many-body equation. What we're going to do is we're going to solve this instead of solving this as some differential equation, we're going to solve this as a very large matrix. And as Wick said, thanks in large part to supercomputers and some new technology, we can do these in dimensions up to about 10 billion now. This matrix is very sparse, and we usually want a few low-lying states. So again, what we're doing is we're doing this thing called configuration interaction. That just means we're expanding in a basis, and the Hamilton, we need to know these Hamiltonian, these many-body matrix elements in some basis. And then this becomes a matrix eigenvalue problem. We like these basis states to be orthonormal, and then we can just use this matrix formulation. Now this is, again, sort of the exact opposite philosophy of the quantum Monte Carlo calculations that Ken was describing. Here, he chooses basically one state that's very, very complicated, and you build as much physics into it as possible. And that's basically what that variational Monte Carlo is that he was describing. You have all those correlations and so forth. You build those in, and you work very, very hard on that one state. But because it's so heavily correlated to all the integrals over it, they're very difficult integrals, so you have to evaluate those by Monte Carlo. I go to the far end of the spectrum where I choose the simplest possible basis states as possible. I basically use which are called M-scheme Slater determinants. I don't think I really, if anyone's interested, I can explain what those mean, but let me just say they're very, very simple. And so what we do is instead of using one really, really complicated state, we use billions of very, very simple states. The advantage of that is that these matrix elements we can calculate extremely fast. In fact, we don't even store all of these anymore. What we do is we have a clever algorithm that we can basically recreate these matrix elements on the fly. So we never even store the entire matrix, not even the non-zero matrix elements in memory. We basically have a way to reconstruct them as we're going along, as we need them. And so that's our advantage in this. Now, the disadvantage, of course, is that we may need millions or even billions of states to get up to the complexity. Again, the theorem about conservation of effort at some level. So, like I said, we solve by diagonalizing a basis of many body states. These Slater determinants, they're anti-symmetrized product of single particle wave functions. Typically, we use a harmonic oscillator basis, although there's no reason why you could not use something else if it's more convenient. And we work in occupation representation. One advantage of occupation representation is everything is automatically anti-symmetrized. You have no worries about making sure everything is anti-symmetrized. It comes out automatically. And in these codes, basically what you do is you choose your space that you're acting in. Now, there's a reference already to the no-coarse shell model, and we'll talk a little bit about that. In the old-style phenomenological spaces, you would have an inert core, then some valence space, but of course you have to exclude some space. And this is, again, goes back to sort of the conservation of effort. It's a very flexible approach. One can get many, many eigenvalues all at once, but the limitations you have is you have a limited valence space in which your particles can act. But again, there's flexibility in that once you've chosen this, you can put in your interactions. Your interactions are basically just a set of numbers. So it doesn't matter whether they're local or non-local or anything like that. As long as someone can calculate for you what the two-body or three-body matrix elements are in there, you can put them in there. It doesn't matter whether it's a harmonic oscillator basis or a Wood-Saxon basis or Hertree-Fock or something. All you need is a list of numbers, and you can then run it through your code. So there's a great deal of flexibility in that. Okay, so let me point out, again, as was mentioned, this is not your grandfather's shell model. Sometimes, you know, I run into my colleagues, or usually friends of colleagues. My colleagues actually know better, but friends of colleagues, they introduce me, and they say, what do you work on? I say, I work on the nuclear shell model, and they say, oh, do people still do that? Well, this is not your grandfather's, or in the case of Maria Gippert-Meyer, not your grandmother's shell model anymore. In the old shell model, you had a good description of data, but it was basically a detailed phenomenological model. And the phenomenology continues to improve. But today, we can start from high-precision nuclear forces, and we get good agreement without fitting to many, many body data points. What I should emphasize is that we're starting from basically NN data, and then we can then build ourselves up. And just to give you an idea of some of the stuff that we get out, we can get energy levels of light nuclei, we can get good phase shifts in light systems. Recently, people have calculated, even from first principles, the carbon-14 half-life, which is actually an extremely difficult thing to get correctly because there are large cancellations. And again, the important point is that these things are largely done without trying to adjust any parameters to get them right. And here's another example of something we've done. This is something we have a paper in the archive. We're still fighting with referees. This is a first principles calculation of the E1 response in boron 10. And this is the experimental data, and this is our calculation. And so this is a giant giant dipole resonance in boron 10, but again, this is a first principles calculation. That is, there are no adjustable parameters in this. Essentially, we ran the calculation, and we get a very good description of experiment. So this is just a sort of a taster menu of what one can do with these type of calculations. And this is very different from what was done in sort of old-style shell model calculations, where again, you would sort of adjust various things like your models, your H-bar omega, and so forth, until you got a good description of data. So what one starts off with is you start off with you do have to fit at some point to data. Like Andre and other people said, at some point, this doesn't come from nowhere. Even in QED, the value of the fine structure constant, despite the crackpots who come and tell you, they can tell you why it's 137 point something, in reality, we have to fit that to data. There's just nuclear forces more complicated. We have to fit to scattering data. And there are still a variety of forces on the market. There's the venerable argon potential favored by the quantum Monte Carlo people because they're mostly local. There's the chiral effective field theory ones. There's various phase equivalent potentials. Hopefully someday Wicks-Hallbutt potentials will come online and we can use those. All of these agrees on the phase shifts, largely because that's what they're fitted to. So phase shifts, deuteron binding energies, and so forth. They do differ on what you'd call the off-shell matrix elements, which are connected to the three-body matrix elements, and will have some differences in many-body things. In two-body systems, they all agree. So this is where we start. We start with at this level. In order to put it into a shell model calculation, we usually have to do some sort of softening, because you do have something that looks like a hard core, and so we have a unitary transformation. This goes under the singularly unhelpful name of the similarity renormalization group, but what it does is it basically is a unitary transformation that tries to decouple the high momentum components from the low momentum components. So those are the ones that are very difficult in the shell model, because remember, at some level we have to restrict our space. We can't just put in arbitrary correlations like you can in quantum Monte Carlo. Because this is a unitary transformation, you don't get something for nothing. So these will induce additional three and four body forces. Although in a recent paper, I argued the main effect of these things is essentially to shift your energies up or down. So there's actually less effect, there's some effect, but the less effect on the wave functions. So the main important points is we start from NN scattering data, we maybe do a unitary transformation, soften the hard core, and now we can work in the no core shell model space, which was already mentioned. The basic idea here is that you have all particle active, so you no longer have a core. This reduces what we call the intruder states. Intruder states are basically, again, a fancy term for saying things that are outside of your model space, but that actually energetically should be within your region. Now, there are still some intruder states, I'm going to mention them, but they're more complicated. Things such as the Hoyle state in carbon 12 and the second O2 state in oxygen 16 are basically intruders. The no core shell model has problems with those states.
Jerry Brown many years ago made the argument that zero plus state in oxygen was a four particle form.
Well,
that should be in your space.
Yeah, but when you actually do the detailed calculation, four particle four hole is not enough. So it is a cluster. It is a cluster state, but it's not just simple. It is a four particle four hole, but it's not just like a four H bar omega excitation. When people like Thomas Neff have done calculations in their fermionic, you see that you need excitations up to like 30 H bar omega to really properly describe that. So it is basically an alpha particle cluster, but it requires a lot more correlations than what we saw. So on one hand, he's right, but it's still more subtle than we thought. So modern high-performance computing allows us to go to much larger model spaces. So back in 1989, when I was finishing up my PhD with Wick, essentially a four-particle, four-hole calculation, this is what Eric asked me about, because I wrote this for my thesis, This dimension was about 1.2 million basis states. And in fact, we cheated. We were able to divide it up into four separate pieces, and we only basically did about 300,000 states at a time. So what we were doing is we were finding low-lying eigenstates of matrices about 300,000 by 300,000. And so that was roughly the state of the art back in the 1980s. It would take about a day on a VAX workstation or an hour on a Cray supercomputer back then. Today, we can do the lingo we use is nmax, which is more appropriate thing. What nmax means is essentially number of harmonic oscillator excitations. So you can either excite one particle up 8 oscillator shells or 8 particles up 1 oscillator shell. And the advantage of that is that you can preserve translational invariance for that. And the reason why I say that is it seems like, at least the evidence, that other calculations in different framework try to get the Hoyle state is they seem to need up to like 30 oscillator excitations to properly define the Hoyle state. So even though it's a four particle correlation, it's a very strongly correlated state that's more than just simply moving four particles from the P shell up to the SD shell. So we can do nmax up to 8 for oxygen 16. That's about 1 billion basis. And this is actually kind of state of the art. One could get up to about nmax 10 for oxygen 16. This would be a dimension of about 24 billion basis states. And that's basically within sight. Haven't quite pulled this off yet, but that's definitely within sight. And so with my collaborators, we've written a massive shell model code that's publicly available. If anyone really wants to run their own shell model calculations, you don't believe me, you can run your own. It's free and open source. There's a 100-page manual I wrote if you want to figure out how to run it. You have to supply your own interaction, though. So it uses the simple M scheme basis. Like I said, it has this factorization. So unlike in the old codes where you would have to store at least the non-zero matrix elements, these M scheme Hamiltonians are very sparse. On the order of only like 1 in a million matrix elements are non-zero. And you think, well, that should be trivial. But still, if you think about a billion, 1 out of a million of a billion times a billion, that's actually still terabytes of data. So the advantage of the factorization is that we don't have to store all those non-zeros. And just to give you a very simple idea of how the factorization is, essentially what we're doing is we're looping over spectators. You basically store the matrix elements of the particles that are interacting, and then you can loop over spectator particles. It's not quite that simple, but that's the basic idea. So we can do that. This code has both OpenMP and MPI parallelization. I can run sizable calculations up to probably about 10 million basis states on my laptop. On a nice desktop, I can do a few hundred million, and to get up to the billions, I need to go to a supercomputer. Okay, so let me just tell you sort of about the capabilities of what we could do for you in terms of these calculations, both for parity mixing and maybe for Annapel moments and so forth. For fluorine 18, we could do nmax equals 6 for positive parity, that's the dimension of 426 million. For nmax 7, the opposite parity is about 2.7 billion. Again, that's pretty much within reach. It's a little bit pushing the technology. And this is just really about how many supercomputer nodes you can grab at a time. So what we can do, of course, is we can study the convergence as we go up an oscillator quantum. What we do is we start with a smaller calculation and work our way up. And the advantage of this new no-core shell model technology is you don't readjust the interaction for each model space. You basically have a fixed interaction, and then you study the convergence as you go up in model space. And so we can study the convergence in nmax, which is again the number of these oscillator quantity of whatever things we want. There's also some new ideas coming out where we use not harmonic oscillator orbitals, but we go to something called natural orbitals. Mark Caprio and Robert Rote of Darmstadt have worked on this. And this seems to improve convergence and your robustness. You start off on a harmonic oscillator basis, but then you transform to this thing called the natural orbital basis, which is actually well known in atomic and molecular physics. And so this actually gains you the equivalent of almost 1 or 2 nmax excitations. If you want to do fluorine 19, I know I was tasked with fluorine 18, but I figured, well, I can do this. If you did the same calculations, this would be about $1.3 billion and $8.5 billion for the two different parities in fluorine 19. More practice, if you want to do neon 21, you know, you might as well get ambitious. Neon 21, well, did the same equivalent calculation is pretty hard. To get the NMAC 7 negative parity would be about $71 billion. And while I dream of getting to that someday, that's not going to happen anytime in the next couple of years. But we could certainly do a smaller calculation. And if we understood the convergence properties, again, this gives us a way to sort of see how robust these things are. And just for grins, I was thinking about the alpha, since we were talking about this, the alpha plus a proton or a neutron calculations. Here you can do up to fairly high NMAX for fairly modest model spaces up to about 1 billion and so forth. And I'm actually trying to put together a proposal where we would actually look at scattering states within a shell model basis. So this is something I'm now inspired to think about, is how would we try to do this. Okay, so but one big concern I do have are these you know, four particle, four hole states, which are actually clearly much more complicated to that. And the reason I know that they're that is that those states appear way too high in any no-core shell model calculation. They're nowhere near where they need to be in either carbon 12 or in the oxygen 16. They're pushed up much higher in energy. And so near this the boundary between the P and the SD shell, we see these strong four-particle, four-hole correlations. The Hoyle state, the 6 MeV, zero-plus state in oxygen 16. And so at least in the no-core shell model, they probably can't be arrived at by brute force. That just adding, even going up to another NMAX 8 or 10 is probably not going to be enough. And to give you an evidence of this, so this is, again, you know, this is sort of a nostalgia talk. So this is the oxygen 16 gamma teller was actually measured at Triumph. And this is very sensitive, essentially, to the fragmentation of the smearing of the Fermi surface in oxygen 16. So if oxygen 16 were exactly a closed core nucleus, you would have zero gamma teller strength. But it's not. It's smeared due to particle hole excitations. And so if you measure it, you can tell something about this. This is actually from my PhD thesis. The dotted line is from my PhD thesis, and the solid line is from the experiment that was done at Triumph. But we basically cheated. What we did is we added single particle energies to pull down those four particle, four hole states. So we did that until we got the zero plus at the right place. And then we, in fact, see we got a good agreement with experiment. Actually, this is a prediction. The experiment came after my PhD thesis. Now, this is the gamma teller distribution that I calculated. This is the no core calculation, and this is the running sum. So you can't quite compare. This is just the smeared strength function here. I did the running sum, but you can see by comparison, this has lost strength around 10 MeV, and there's almost no strength in this calculation at 10 MeV. And this is because there's not enough smearing of the Fermi surface in oxygen 16, and this is still an NMAX 6 calculation. So this allows up to six particle, six hole calculations in the no-core shell model, and you're not getting nearly enough low-lying strength. Anyway, now what I think one could try to do this is at least to sort of see what the effect of these things are. It's not clear to me what effect these correlations would have on the matrix elements we care about, either the PNC mixing matrix elements in fluorine 18 or anapole matrix elements or something. But you could at least test it. You could artificially lower these four particle, four hole states by changing, like I did many years ago, changing the single particle energies, maybe, or adding monovolt terms or something like that. It would no longer be, you know, ab initio, but at least you could sort of see, well, if you bring these down so you get more fragmentation of the Fermi surface, does it give you better agreement? I mean, how much effect does it have on our parity-violating matrix elements that we care about? And also, we have good ways we can test it to see whether it's realistic. We can look at that measured gamma teller response. We can look at the location of the zero plus states in carbon 12 and oxygen 16. So this is my biggest concern in doing these calculations, but I think there's a way we can at least try to address it. So just to summarize, we're in sort of a new golden age of nuclear structure calculations, powered by new techniques and supercomputers. We can really do rigorous ab initio calculations of many nuclear properties, particularly in lower P shell. As we move up, there's new challenges because these four particle, four hole clusters are actually more complicated than we thought. And so we've got to try to find ways to address those. Thanks.
My sort of practical viewpoint, one very interesting thing for me to see would be for you to calculate the ratio of the perivalent matrix element in 418 and 419 and the axial charge and the corresponding difference in magnitude.
Yeah.
Because if that's you may not need anything more than just n equals 4 or something to understand that. I mean, to see that that's become stable.
Exactly. No, I agree. That's actually sort of what we, I didn't explain that very well, but that's exactly what Wix is suggesting that we do, is to do exactly that.
And I guess I'm just endorsing that.
Okay. Yeah. So I agree that one wants to do that, but you also want to see for a variety of model spaces interactions, see how whether that relationship is robust.
But that's something you can do.
There are very well measured parity violating asymmetries in heavy nuclei. And then, you know, like say tantalum 181, there's a measurement better than 10%. Could you calculate something like that?
Well, so it depends on what you mean by that. So you can see as we go up from fluorine 18 to fluorine 19. To neon 21, the dimensions start to explode. So trying to do a no core shell model calculation, no way. But I am working with trying to develop some new methods to at least expand the regime of phenomenological shell model calculations so that one could try to do those kinds of things. So to try to make it easier to address heavier nuclei with at least more better phenomenological shell model calculations. Because even today, a phenomenological shell model calculation for tantalum would be basically impossible. But I have a couple of schemes that hopefully, and a good graduate student, a couple of graduate students who are working on that, that we hope that within the next couple of years, we will be able to tackle heavy nuclei. But we would not be in this, in a full no-core shell model, no, I don't think that's possible. But in a better phenomenological shell model, we can hopefully improve our cesium calculations. And so forth.
How about potassium 41?
Same. That still basically would have to be phenomenological. Better phenomenological, but still phenomenological.
Yeah. Could you maybe comment on how much better it gets as you go, you know, from no core to small core to cesium? Is it qualitatively worse if once that core gets bigger, or is it sort of all or nothing?
Well, the main thing you lose is it becomes a lot harder to quantify what your error is. So you're asking about what the theoretical error is, and part of the reason why we do the no core shell model is there's ways, and we're working on this, to more rigorously assess what is the uncertainty in your calculation in the no core. For one thing, just by saying, well, as you go from here to here, how does that change? Once you start putting in a core, it becomes much harder to do that. Now, I'm trying to educate myself on this thing called uncertainty quantification, even for phenomenological things, but that's not really been done. Uncertainty quantification of phenomenological shell models has not really been done. I want to get into that game or start that game, but it hasn't been done, so it's a lot harder to quantify the uncertainty once you start putting in a core, because then you are quantifying phenomenology. So that's the real thing that happens once you go start putting a core, is it becomes phenomenological, and it's a lot harder to figure out what your errors are. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I guess I would just comment, you know, back when I started in this business in the AMO community, there was, I would say, the traditional way of quantifying uncertainties was as you were describing, what happens when I change, you know, the size of my basis set. But then there was a real push towards saying, you have to do that, of course, but you also have to benchmark every observable that you can calculate and, you know, really do a full tabulation of what the uncertainties are. Of course, often there is extremely precise data, so, you know, that benchmarking was easy, but, yeah, that's something that...
Well, nuclear physics is behind AMO in that, so PhysRev-A requires even theoretical calculations to have theoretical error bars, which PhysRev-C not right now. However, in the nuclear community, we're getting much more serious about uncertainty quantification and so forth. So we're trying to catch up, as in so many things, in that area.
I just had one comment. Just thinking about the shell models, if you actually reduce it to a single shell, then you can actually do it as an effective theory. There are a set of matrix elements that would give you the right result, which means the projection of the real wave function to that space. The problem is that once you go beyond one shell, you no longer can do that. You can prove that the functional form of the shell model interaction is not the correct functional form. So then it becomes a model. So the only reason you get reliable results and why all these huge calculations are important is if you keep expanding and expanding and expanding the basis, you can eventually beat those uncontrolled errors down to zero, as you approach an exact calculation. So by showing that convergence is okay. But that's why you can't do anything heavy, because parity violation always requires you to have at least two shells, because you have to do even and odd parity. And therefore, you know the functional form is a model. It's not in any way controlled. In a heavy nucleus, you can't do multiple shells, so you can't see how big your errors are. So you just know the answer is wrong, and you can't put an error bar. It's a model, it's not a theory.
I guess I have one quick question in regards to your E1 response and boron hem. You had your curve, actually, at low excitation energy was actually the wrong curvature with respect to the data. It curved like this, and the data seemed to go in the opposite sense. Any insight on why that would be and what to do to address it? I just wonder if this is the first calculation,
yeah.
But nevertheless, much is clear.
Yeah, none of this, no, I don't at this time. It's something to think about, but.
Okay, so that one perspective where you just, okay, fine. I was going to wonder if something, can you imagine if you added more shells, that you would be able to a better calculation?
It may have, yeah, but it could also have to do with details of the fine structure, so that could also be the forces. So that force, that didn't have three body forces in it, so that could affect, that calculation did not have three body forces, which can affect the forks can overorder, you know, of the shell, so that actually could affect the low lines, fine structure, which would affect that. But that just a guess.
Okay. Well, let's thank Kaplan's. Oh.